This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. We stream live at the same time at prairiepublic.org. And it's a pleasure to have you with us, especially on a membership drive day. We are in our short and sweet membership drive. So if you're inclined to, you know, predestine your decision, go ahead and pick up the phone and give us a call, 800-359-4145, or go online to prairiepublic.org. It doesn't take very long. It's very important and deeply appreciated. And today, Ashley Thornburg and I are pleased to have with us, and our microphones in Bismarck, James Woolner, the producer of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. James, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's really great to be here. I'm excited.
And with you, Mike Wald, who plays an important role in the telling of the story that you tell in Season 2 of Dakota Spotlight. Mike, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having us.
Why don't you go ahead and set up Season 2? What's the elevator speech, James?
An untold story about two wonderful people who were murdered in cold blood in 1976 in a rural town called Zeeland. Population 300. And, you know, it's, as I say on the podcast, we've heard of win-win things. This is a lose-lose story. It is a sad story, but it was also untold, and I came across it and felt it really needed to be told at this time, especially because it's been quite a while.
Well, it has been quite a while. I was a news guy back then, and this story and others, of course, around that time, it was sort of a turbulent period in North Dakota's history, tells about a 1976 bank robbery in Zeeland and a double murder that centered around that as well, and all the lives that were topsy-turvied because of that. Let's get a little background, though, about the Dakota Spotlight, James. What is it, and why do you do it?
Well, you know, I've always loved audio storytelling. I love Prairie Public, NPR. I've always appreciated the fact that you can use your imagination a little more than when watching television, and you can do other things. I just love that style of storytelling. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I got interested in this with, you know, podcasts have become very popular. And I was up here in North Dakota, and I thought, you know, I'm going to give this a try, and I've always been interested in investigative journalism, research. I really enjoy research and looking for sort of the reason behind why things happened and, you know, the truth, hopefully.
And people can find out more at DakotaSpotlight.com. That's your website.
Correct.
And how are you supported? How are you funded? How do you make a
it's not my day job. I have no, as I say, I'm just one guy with a microphone working really hard to bring these stories to people, and it's not funded by anyone other than myself. You know, in this season, too, I have had some wonderful listeners who have donated a little bit of money to see some bonus content. So they've been really great, and I've got really great feedback. But otherwise, it's just me behind this.
Why did you want to revisit this story?
I think it comes back to this sense of justice. You know, I have this – I don't like it when I feel like justice is not being served. And in this case, I'm not talking about the punishment of the three people who were involved in this crime. I'm talking about the justice of the story being told, Wade and Ellen Zick, who were murdered. I was surprised that there was no book or story. You know, there's a few things on Facebook, but there's just nothing there. And I thought – It wasn't right, I guess, that the story had not been told.
Mike, Wade and Ellen Zick were your grandparents. Tell us about them.
Well, they were great people. I mean, I kept telling James that, and my sister and I, when we were visiting with James, that they were dressed all the time, tops. I mean, she had dress on, jewelry. I never saw him in a pair of blue jeans. It was always a shirt and tie. Very professional, but great people.
Church.
He was a banker, yeah. Right?
Yeah, he worked in the bank, and they were very involved in the church. He was the choir director, and she sang in the choir, and the people just, like I said, or like the story says, expected him to be there.
Yeah, Well, obviously well-loved in your own family, but well-loved, well-regarded in the town.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was part in the podcast where they joked that, you know, someday he's going to, they'll show him what it's like without having them there. And,
right.
And you know, it brought a lot of that back, you know, that the respect and, you know, how, what they did for the community.
And it's such a small community, James. It's kind of curious that these three people who were eventually convicted and spent time for this crime, or a couple of them still in prison, what was the motive? I mean, obviously they were robbing a bank, but what were they thinking?
Yeah, I've got that question a lot. You know, what were they thinking? It was just really a really stupid thing to do. They got it in their head. There was supposedly a significant amount of alcohol and drugs, at least marijuana, involved, they say. And they started talking about robbing a bank sort of as a joke, and it just progressed. That's sort of the story. But, you know, there's a lot of – they obviously didn't think it through very well, considering the way they handled it after it happened and, you know, leaving Wade and Ellen on the property of two of the convicted murderers. They left them on their own property. I don't know how they thought that was, you know – wasn't very well thought through, as you say.
Well, let's get a sample of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. This is just a brief snippet of finding the bodies.
Tin and used car tires were piled on a pile, and I removed the tires and started removing some of the tin. Then I discovered two bodies, which I believed then to belong to Mr. and Mrs. Wade Sick. Enough was seen and felt that I could feel no sign of life on the bodies as such, and from what I saw, I was convinced that there was no life left.
Now, who is that voice we're hearing, or who is being impersonated there?
That is Sheriff Milton Wiest, the McIntosh County Sheriff at the time. And two men from Zeeland found the bodies, and then they went in to the school where a command center had been set up that Sunday night. They'd been looking for the Zicks for several hours. And these two guys came in and told the sheriff they'd like him to come out and look at something, because what they told me was that it was so dark and what they saw was so strange that they couldn't even be sure that what they were looking at was, you know, two bodies. They thought maybe it was a doll or something, actually. Mm-hmm. So that was Sheriff Milton Wiest who drove out there, went down there and did that. And,
Were people hesitant to talk to you?
Only some. Most people were very eager to talk. I want to thank the people in Zeeland, obviously the Wald family and other loved ones of the Zicks. People were mostly very eager. The people who did not want to speak with me were two of the convicted men decided not to partake, while another one did correspond with me from prison through letters.
James Wolner is the producer of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. And James, you use interviews with people who live through the experience, but you also have actors recreating others in the story. How were those roles created?
Well, I guess the only voice actors I use are when we're working from a document. You know, like I said before, I'm really big into research. I do a lot of open records requests. And so if I'm not able to speak with the person who wrote that report, I'll either narrate it myself or simply get an actor to do it.
And again, a small town, and they obviously knew some people were missing and there was some suspicion around the bank. We've got another little piece of audio here about how the townspeople were sort of told roughly what had happened.
And I remember Joe Locker saying, "Well, what can you tell us about where Wade and Ellen are now?" And Milton Wiest said, "What I can tell you is, folks, you won't have a banker tomorrow morning." And the gasps came out because the Zicks were highly regarded. But what I just remember, and that's what sticks with me, you know, from my memory as a kid, was the gasps and then the crying that started and people embracing themselves. But that's how Milton Wiest announced to the community. He said, "I can tell you, you won't have a banker tomorrow morning."
Wow.
Yeah.
1976.
It's amazing to me always when it is a traumatic event like this, and in such a small town, it always is going to just rock the entire town.
Right.
That even decades later, people have strong emotional memories.
Absolutely.
But I'm wondering about the fact-checking. How did you do your research? Because memory is not sufficient.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things, the more interviews you do, the better, obviously. For example, David Feist, who I did correspond with in prison, told me that several times that I was being served what he called, you know, baloney, or he used BS, actually. He was, you know, telling me that what people were telling, people in Zealand were telling me about him couldn't have possibly been true because he hadn't even met any people in Zealand and so on. In the podcast, I've interviewed at least four or five people who definitely say the contrary. And I never claim that David Feist is lying, but I let the listeners draw their own conclusions. If you have five people claiming that he was kind of a scary dude, then, you know.
And he was 21 at the time, and his two accomplices, Sebastian Feist and Gregory Jean Huber, were 18. So
correct.
These were young men. And how long did it take, really, for them to kind of piece together what had happened and go looking for these three?
It went really quick. So it started out that the Zicks didn't show up for church in the morning. And that was very, very strange because, as Mike said here, you know, Wade was the choir director and Ellen was in the choir and he was very dedicated to the church. He never missed church. So they knew already something was wrong. But they figured, you know, something – they actually gone up to visit Mike and his family, gone up to Bismarck to visit the day before. So they thought maybe, you know, car trouble or something. And then in mid-afternoon, someone went to their house, tried to find, you know, knocked on the door, and someone actually went inside, went upstairs, and noticed that the bed wasn't made. And at that point, she called Francis Streifel, who was the assistant bank manager. He went to the bank and found the back door ajar, money missing, and called the sheriff. And so it was all moving pretty quickly, I have to say. But they just didn't find the Zicks until about 10 p.m. after dark.
And that was on some property that of a relation to the Feists, wasn't it?
Correct.
How long did it take them to connect the Feists and Huber to this case?
It was about 6 p.m. that Sunday evening, July 11th, when actually, you remember when the people used to have the
party line.
Party line type deal. Thank yes.
You. Yeah. So, yeah, back then there was a lot of people, farmsteads out there had a party line, and there were some people on the phone talking about this bank robbery. And did you hear? People are looking for the Zicks. And it was actually Sebastian and David Feist's grandmother who picked up the phone and said, I think I might know, it might be my grandsons, because they came in here at 3 in the morning or 4, grabbed their stuff, and left in a big hurry.
Okay. Mike, what were you told, and when were you told about the murders of your grandparents?
Well, we were notified that Sunday here in Bismarck that they couldn't find them. And so we were actually, my sister and I were actually kind of shuffled over to our neighbor's house, and so our parents could, you know, kind of figure out what was going on and that sort of thing. And then we got loaded up in the car and headed down to Zealand. And so, you know, being 9 years old, you kind of had an idea that something wasn't quite right, but you didn't know the magnitude of it until actually, you know, later on that day. You know, James in Dakota Spotlight has some photos of my family in front of the bank. I mean, that was the only place we could go when we got there. So we're standing outside of the bank, you know, waiting for any type of news that could come about. So, you know, from there on, it was just, you know, kind of looking at people's reaction and trying to read through that on, you know, what was actually going on. And we just knew it wasn't right.
Did you learn anything in the course of the podcast that you didn't already know about your grandparents' murder?
Well, you know, I had ideas, but the greatest thing through the podcast was, you know, actually hearing is it a step-by-step or play-by-play of what went on as far as, you know, the search. And, you know, I knew the headquarters were at the school. And but I didn't realize, and it's in the podcast, and I told James this, that they had a barricade stretched across the street by kids on bikes that they wouldn't let – they were told not to let anybody through. Wow. And so you got teenagers on pedal bikes holding, you know, holding the line. So it was things like that. You know, the other thing that I didn't realize is that the small amount of money that was actually taken from the bank.
$3,000.
Yeah. And you know, really? Was it worth it? And, you know, that was the biggest, you know, some of the biggest things, you know, that I learned. And going into this, we told James, I want to learn as much from you as you want to get from us. And that definitely, you know, is in there. It's in the story.
Well, they were murdered with a shotgun. And obviously, it's a small town, and everybody is wondering, where are they now? So in the Dakota Spotlight podcast in season two, in the second episode, there's a discussion of fear.
You know, they were afraid. No one knew what was going to happen. So that night, his whole family, including his dad, two brothers, they went upstairs into a bedroom. His dad obviously was an old World War II veteran, and they turned off all the lights in the house, and they were all in one room with protection and slept with the lights off. It was pretty nasty.
James, whose voice is that?
That's John Reedy. He was going to be a junior in high school that summer. And he's in the podcast quite a bit. He did a great job of kind of giving us the sense of what was going on in town. He took part in the search as well, mm-hmm. on his motorcycle. He, like many other people I spoke with, that weekend, that event is just burned into their memories.
Mike, James mentioned that he talked with David, who was convicted of the murders, alongside his brother Sebastian and then accomplice Gregory. Did you talk to David, or would you have wanted to?
No, I didn't talk to him, and I'm not sure if I would really want to, or any, you know, anybody from my family would want to. It's just, I don't know. I don't know what I'd say to him. You know, there was one question that, you know, I would ask is why, you know, and I don't know if we really got a straight answer from him of why, but I, you know, that would be the only thing that I'd have to would want to ask him. And I thought it was very interesting, you know, throughout the podcast, the correspondence and what he did have to say, because, you know, you always wonder, you know, what were they thinking? What was going through their mind? I mean, and how did they go about it? And, you know, they talked about it for quite a while and about doing this. So, yeah, I just don't think I would want to, you know, have any conversation with them.
James, do descendants of the victims or the perpetrators still live in the Zeeland area?
There are some, yes. And I spoke with some of them who, you know, declined to speak with me. And I do want to say that I have great empathy for all the people in this story, including the Feist family and the Huber family. And there was a part of me who, you know, I did consider this. Now, is this something that obviously it's not going to be the greatest thing for them that this story comes to light again? But I thought about it for a long time, and I just decided that my empathy for the loved ones of the Zicks just supersedes that empathy for the others a little enough that I felt like this story needs to be told now. You know, a lot of people have passed away already. People were, you know, I've interviewed a few people who were 92, 93 years old. And, you know, 10 years from now, that might not be possible.
James Woolner is the producer of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. You can find out more at dakotaspotlight.com. Thank you for being with us, James.
Thank you guys so much for having me again. I really appreciate it.
And Mike Wald, grandson of Wade and Ellen Zick, the victims who were murdered in 1976 in Zeeland. Thank you, Mike, for spending some time with us as well.
Well, thanks for having us. And again, big shout out to James and the story he's done. It turned out the way we wanted it to.
Valentine's Day is near, and it's time again for Prairie Public's Short and Sweet Drive. You make a contribution of $10 a month or $120 a year to support our public radio service, and we will send out a one-pound box of delicious handmade cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry in time for Valentine's Day. And, you know, we'll put a card in and write something for you. Now, Happy Valentine's Day is fine, but what if you had a line from a poem? E.E. Cummings wrote, "Love is more thicker than forget." Think about that, or whatever line you want. Just let us know when you call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org.
Well, that was a wonderful way to remind you that Main Street is supported by listeners who become members. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. You've been hearing our voices today on our statewide radio broadcast. And, of course, we've got Skip Wood, who's manning the controls and keeping us on time in the control room. But this is our Short and Sweet Fun Drive, as Bill just mentioned, Ashley.
Yeah, and you can support our mission here when you call 1-800-359-4145 or when you click and join and become or renew or increase your membership at prairiepublic.org. And, you know, Doug, I was really struck in that conversation with James and Mike about the podcast that James produces that he said he was heavily influenced by NPR and by audio storytelling and how popular podcasts are right now. And I think of a phrase like, we are standing on the shoulders of giants, because podcasting would not be what it is today without the pioneering efforts of NPR stations across the country. There are very few podcasts out there who don't take a cue from NPR and how to do that level of storytelling. So I want to thank James for recognizing something like that. And thanks to you, all our members who make this possible. It starts with a simple investment. 1-800-359-4145 is the number to call to make that investment. You can also do it online at prairiepublic.org. And of course, we have these chocolates.
Yeah, $10 a month, $120 a year. You decide how you want to pay it, but you get a box of wonderful cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. They are handmade and they are delicious, and they're a wonderful way to say, you know, I like you, or maybe even I like myself. But however you want to gift it, it's a nice little premium for those of you who joined during our Short and Sweet membership drive. And you were mentioning podcasts, and of course Main Street, after it's broadcast and streams live from 3 to 4 Central Time weekdays and Sunday mornings at 10 Central, it is podcast and it's available forever. It's an archive that you can always sample, and we very much appreciate the fact that it's there for us as well. You know, the majority of the funding that it takes to run Prairie Public, to pay those programming fees from NPR, to invest in the equipment, to maintain a network of radio towers and transmitters that are all across the state, and that is a significant investment. And of course, the staff that creates the programming that you're listening to right now comes from the generosity of folks like you. Listeners who've decided to invest in what they're listening to. So keep doing it. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. Coming up on Main Street, Madeline reviews another new movie, The Two Popes, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Global attention continues to focus on the coronavirus. Levi Schlosser is a respiratory disease specialist with the North Dakota Health Department. He says efforts to prevent the introduction of the disease into the U.S. have so far been successful. He says that has diminished the odds of contracting the illness in North Dakota.
Right now, we consider the risk for novel coronavirus to be low for people in the United States.
Schlosser says at this point, a person is more likely to contract influenza than coronavirus. He says when it comes to the spread of flu this year...
This year's a little strange in that we're seeing earlier activity than we did last season. That's not entirely unusual. Each flu season is different. But what does make the season a little more unusual is that we are seeing mostly influenza B so far, opposed to influenza A around this time.
Schlosser says 798 cases of influenza have been confirmed this season in North Dakota, compared to 484 last year at this time. Grand Forks fire teams quickly knocked down a fire inside a wall at the J.R. Simplot Company on Wednesday. The department was called out around 3:45 p.m. to the manufacturing plant. When crews arrived, they spotted a smoldering fire inside a freezer wall. Firefighters first removed the wall to douse the flames. There were no injuries. The plant remained open during the call. A damage estimate has yet to be made available. And Governor Burgum wants to reinvest half the proceeds from the state's legacy fund back into the fund. Burgum would use half for targeted needs, such as infrastructure and technology investments. During his State of the State address, Burgum said the legacy fund is designed to help when the oil and gas runs dry.
If you reinvest half of it, then we set ourselves on a path where in just a short 13 years from now, we would have built up over $26 billion legacy fund, which would be, I call it, a good start. Norway's sovereign wealth fund is a trillion. 26 would be a good start.
Democrats aren't yet on board with that.
Half is a little bit strong, maybe, for our caucus right now.
Senate Minority Leader Joan Heckman of New Rockford and House Minority Leader Josh Boshi of Fargo.
Yeah, there's still a lot of unmet needs. We have cut budgets. When we look at an institution like the University of North Dakota, the number of faculty that we have lost, the research initiatives that have gone unfunded that we know create more jobs in the private sector and recruit students to come here. So there's still needs, but that's why our balance will be with making sure that we not only reinvest back in the legacy fund, but how do we create other mechanisms to find solutions.
Boshi says the Democrats will present their ideas for the legacy fund in a few weeks when a special committee set up to study the use of the proceeds meets in Watford City. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Well, there's that big fanfare. It means it's time to talk about another new movie with Matt Olien, our resident film reviewer here on Main Street. And Matt, you went to The Two Popes.
And the title tells you exactly what this film is. It is kind of imagined conversations, not necessarily how it happened. There has been some criticism of this film for not entirely being accurate, but we never quite know what goes behind Vatican doors, do we? So this film chronicles the relationship between Pope Benedict, who is now retired as the Pope, played by Anthony Hopkins, and Pope Francis, the current Pope, played by Jonathan Pryce, the Pope from Argentina. And it's an interesting film because it's directed by Fernando Meirelles, who did City of God and The Constant Gardener. He is a Brazilian film director. And it's really almost comes off like a play. Like there's many scenes where it is just the two of them talking in the garden, talking about faith, talking about these kind of things. And of course, as you know from researching the movie, ultimately it comes down to Benedict's decision to step away and Pope Francis being elected.
And they're both very different people.
They're very different. So there's a lot of really good scenes where they discuss faith, where Benedict thinks Francis is too liberal on some issues, which has turned out to be true, I yes. think, in retrospect, after he took over. But it's really – I did like this film. It is on Netflix, so if you got Netflix, you can see it. There are three major Oscar nominees on Netflix, The Irishman, The Two Popes, and Marriage Story. So this is nominated for two or three Oscars, both of the actors and the screenplay. But I did enjoy it. It's not a great film. It's more – like I said, it's more like watching – the film, remember the film The Two of Us, which was sort of this imagined meeting that did happen between Paul McCartney and John Lennon in 1976 when Paul showed up at the Dakota Hotel and they hung out for the day and kind of made amends with their relationship. And some of that had to be imagined. And I think this is kind of imagined as well. The two actors are phenomenal in these films. Jonathan Pryce got his first ever Oscar nomination. If you've seen Game of Thrones, he played the High Sparrow. Anthony Hopkins, this is the best work Hopkins has done in a long time. I think when he hit his mega fame with Silence of the Lambs and things like that, in the ensuing years, it felt like he was taking paychecks and kind of chewing the scenery in films like Dracula and things like that. But he's very understated as Benedict. And you get the feeling that he plays Benedict as a man who just doesn't have Francis's gifts with other human beings. He does not have that human-to-human connection that Francis seems to have. And Benedict had health problems, of course, which kind of led to his retirement. But he's still alive, gardening at the Vatican. I would recommend that people watch this, whether you're Catholic or not. The sexual abuse allegations do come up in this film. I'm not going to give away quite what happens. But as you know, Doug, there are allegations probably proven by this point that Benedict did know of some of the priests in Europe that were kind of shepherded or shielded. And that is an interesting scene when that finally comes up in the film. Very interesting scene between Hopkins and Price. Two really good performances worthy of their Oscar nominations that happened.
Does the celibacy issue come up?
It doesn't really.
Because
no.
It has since.
Yeah.
Around the time of the film's release,
I get a feeling that is never going to happen within the Catholic Church. But we will see about that. That's not a central issue with the film. The central issue in this film is really the difference between the two men and how they try to come together and how Benedict, despite his criticisms of Francis, actually is sort of on board with him being the successor, whether that was the case or not in reality. We don't know what happened behind closed doors. The voting meetings are very well filmed when they're voting and, you know, when the smoke comes out of the chimney, either saying, yes, we have a new pope or we don't. That was heavily covered in a film called The Shoes of the Fisherman years ago, starring Anthony Quinn. It wasn't a film that's going to get a Best Picture nomination. It's very much confined to sets within the Vatican. There's not a lot of set pieces outside of the Vatican. Most of this takes place within the Vatican walls. There are some excellent flashbacks, though, to Francis's early years in Argentina. I think those were effective because we see what he was like as a man before he took the vows. Because all of these people were at one point, you know, not priests. What was their life like? Was there someone they were thinking of marrying? You know, were they celibate? You know what I mean? And that comes out in the flashbacks, which are shot in black and white of Pope Francis's early years in the 1950s.
I'm always intrigued by the Netflix piece of this new equation in the way films are produced and released. And that is, do you get the sense that the movie is shot more for somebody who's watching it in a living room or a big screen like, you know, The Avengers and all that stuff?
I think this is the perfect film for Netflix. It is not a film that is epic in scope. It's like you're watching The Lion in Winter or Two of Us, the Lennon-McCartney film I mentioned. It very much feels like a play. It feels like you're eavesdropping on conversations between these two very famous men who had to kind of navigate this unprecedented for centuries that a pope would step down when he was still alive. Another great scene happens when Benedict informs him of his decision. And the reaction of Jonathan Pryce is priceless, if I can use that word twice. He's absolutely stunned by what he's hearing. And that scene goes on for a long time. But if you enjoy good acting, good writing, good character development, you will stick with this film.
Those are two actors I really do enjoy watching.
Yeah. And let me also note, Doug, I may not have mentioned this. Price is nominated in the lead actor category, Hopkins in supporting, even though they are essentially on screen the same amount of time, except for the flashbacks.
I was intrigued by that,
yeah.
Sort of like the Hollywood thing.
Pitt and DiCaprio,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. So it's actually been nominated for three Oscars, Best Adapted Screenplay being the third one, and the same listed in the Golden Globes, so it's got that distinction.
Yeah.
So you mentioned one of these other movies, because when I was looking at what Oscar trivia can I ask Matt about the Pope movies, you know? Well, there are two prominent 20th century Pope movies, which also were nominated for Oscars but didn't win any. You mentioned one of them.
The Shoes of the Fisherman in 68.
Yep.
I don't know what categories it was nominated
Anthony
in.
Anthony Quinn and
yeah.
Laurence Olivier, Oscar
right.
winner were in that. It, it was nominated for art direction and musical score. And the other one? I'm looking up at the ceiling, Matt.
Oh, The Agony and the Ecstasy with Charlton Heston and Rex Harrison.
That's right. And that was nominated for cinematography, art direction, sound, music, and costume design. Didn't win anything.
Okay.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. We are in our short and sweet membership drive, which is our, you know, appeal to you who are listening or who may be members. If you're not, please become one. We'd appreciate that. If you are a member, maybe you want to notch it up a bit because, you know, every year things move up in cost, and that affects Prairie Public as well. It's easy to get involved. It's easy to make that investment. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org.
And when you do so, particularly during Main Street, it says to us that you are here for the long-form interviews, that you get to hear 20 minutes with a politician, not a 90-second soundbite, that you get to hear a best-selling author, a regional author, talk about what inspired them, that you get to hear these interesting movie reviews from Matt Olean. An in-house movie reviewer is really a thing to treasure, and you are supporting that level of programming when you call 1-800-359-4145 or when you go online to prairiepublic.org. And when you are thinking about what amount works for you, well, try this $10 a month level. That is the first level that gets you these cocoa truffles. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, take your fingers out of your ears and move out of that cave, because we've been talking about these cocoa truffles because they are fantastic. These are hand-rolled, high-quality cocoa and port and cream, and then they're rolled in cocoa powder, and they are just a little explosion of delightfulness in your mouth. And you can get a pound of them in time for Valentine's Day when you call 1-800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org.
You know, one of the wonderful things about listening to Prairie Public, the moments of surprise and discovery, we like to think we provide them occasionally for you on Main Street. So when you hear a story or a conversation that you didn't know anything about, and you say, wow, I'm kind of interested that I found that out. You know, we sometimes call those driveway moments, when you drive home and you really can't turn off the radio till you hear the end of the story. You're more likely to hear that on Prairie Public and NPR than just about anywhere.
Yeah.
That's what makes it special. And, of course, you make it possible. We call this maybe paying it forward, but our listeners who give us membership support make Prairie Public possible. If you're listening right now and you're not a member, help make us possible. Help make tomorrow possible. Help make next year possible. Pay it forward for that other person who's just tuning in for the first time and may not know what kind of a gold mine they've stumbled across. Give us a call and maybe take home some truffles. 800-359-4145. Or online at prairiepublic.org.
Those driveway moments, Doug, they are so real. I was late for work so many times at my last job because of driveway moments that I finally just had to give up and get a job in public radio, where at least they would totally understand that level of commitment, that fascination that you just can't walk away from a story until it's finished. Main Street is a show that we hope is providing you with driveway moments, and certainly you get them from many other programs across the spectrum that we offer here. You're investing in your own driveway moment when you call 1-800-359-4145 or join at prairiepublic.org.
Yeah, it's time to look at the calendar, Ashley, and find out what's going on for our Main Street listeners. And there is a fair amount. We are changing months. We're inching so slowly, glacially, towards spring. But it's going to happen.
Yes. Well, this event coming up in February, so next month, a little closer to that spring, in Bismarck is the Sensational Sundays Trail Physicians, the medical practices of Lewis and Clark. So easy to take for granted our access to modern medical convenience right now. And when you stop and think about what it was like for explorers who couldn't just pop into a Walgreens on their way or make an appointment or just go to a walk-in clinic. You can learn about what they did. This is, again, on February 2nd at the North Dakota Heritage Center and Museum. There's going to be a park ranger from the Knife River Indian Village's historic site talking about medical practices from the 19th century. Sunday at 2 p.m., and it's free, and it includes antique and reproduction equipment.
On Monday, the BO String Quartet concert takes place in Jamestown at the Art Center right downtown. That quartet brings its evocative program, Farewells, to North Dakota this winter. This project explores the nature of beginnings and endings, well wishes for the departed, and how the expressiveness of music can bloom when words are not enough. It's Monday evening at 7:30. It's free. It's at the Jamestown Art Center.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra is hosting Story Time with their guest narrator, Teacher of the Year for North Dakota, Sarah Madalin. This is coming up February 1st in Minot at Main Street Books. She will be doing a reading of Jonathan Lithgow's book, The Remarkable Farkle McBride, which just sounds amazing already. And this is going to be part of the Minot Symphony Orchestra concert that's coming up on the 8th, but you can hear just the reading on the 1st at Main Street Books. Again, that is on Saturday. It is at 10 a.m. And from that event, you can buy tickets to the February 8th performance, which will feature a full orchestra.
If you like quirky, dark dramas, The Moors is for you. It's in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center. It opens today and runs through February 2nd, then February 6th through the 8th, and the 13th through the 15th. The Moors is a dark comedy about love, desperation, and visibility. And again, it runs Thursday through Sundays at 7:30. The tickets are $16 to $20. The Moors at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks.
Here's a good one for genealogists. This is a genealogy presentation in Dickinson on the 1st at the Public Library. Genealogists have known for a long time that cemeteries are a good place to go to get lots of information. But of course, that's only if you know how to find that information and sometimes how to interpret that information. So there's going to be a presentation at the Dickinson Library on the 1st, and so that is Saturday at 2 p.m., and it's going to help you navigate some of the genealogy websites that are specific to graveyards, like Find a Grave and Billion Graves, that might help you find more information about whatever you are interested in. And this presentation is free.
Well, if you're hungry, the 61st anniversary Scout Troop 214 Golden Brown Pancake Feed is in Fargo Saturday at the Fargo Civic Center. Of course, pancakes, homemade syrup, sausage, eggs, applesauce, juice, milk, coffee, and ice cream. It's breakfast Saturday from 7 till 1 in the afternoon. Tickets are $7 in advance or $9 at the door. This is the Golden Brown Pancake Feed for Scout Troop 214 in Fargo.
The University of Mary Jazz Festival, so this is going to be on the 31st, the last day of January here. There's going to be a concert featuring the flautist Nestor Torres. This is at the Lumen Vitae University Center at the University of Mary. Friday at 7:30. It's free and open to the public and also has some local performers joining as well.
The Baroque Festival concert is in Fargo on Saturday at Peace Lutheran Church, live classical music and a student concert. It's, again, Saturday at 7:30 in the evening. It is free, and it's hosted by NDSU Performing Arts. And what's your pick this week?
Mine is the Yoga Brunch and Shred. This is in Wahala at Frostfire Park. And so that is a ski lodge that has recently reopened. And yoga is such an exceptional practice for helping you prepare, well, for life in general, but especially other sporting events where balance and not wanting to fall over are pretty important, like skiing and snowboarding. So you can do this. It gets going Saturday at 8 a.m. Please bring your own yoga mat. You can do just the yoga or just the skiing or both and, you know, throw in that brunch while you're at it.
Well, if you've never seen flamenco dancing, this is your opportunity. Flamenco Vivo Calarta Santana will be featured on Saturday in Moorhead at Minnesota State University Moorhead in Hanson's Theater. It's pride, passion, love, sorrow. You know, flamenco dancers and musicians bring a lot of passion to the job. So you'll hear diverse influences which have shaped this exuberant form of dance and music. It includes Gypsy, Judaic, Arabic, Spanish, and Latino cultures. And Carlotta Santana co-founded Flamenco Vivo in 1983 with a mission to bring flamenco to other cultures. This is your opportunity Saturday at 7:30 at the Hanson Theater at MSU Moorhead. The tickets are $12 to $28. That's what's happening.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 30th. January is a crucial month for gardeners. By the end of the month, seed catalogs are dog-eared, orders are penciled in, and colorful dreams and schemes begin to solidify. So it was on this date in 1932 when a group of North Dakota and Manitoba gardeners and dreamers went public with plans for a new garden in the Turtle Mountains that would span the 49th parallel between Dunseith, North Dakota, and Boisevane, Manitoba. Not a vegetable garden, mind you, but a 3,000-acre plot containing hills and trees and lakes to be dedicated as a natural monument to peace. The sponsors announced that the site would be known as the International Peace Garden, free of commercialism, with half of the land in the United States and half in Canada. They said it would be a shrine to peace. The idea grew out of annual peace picnics that had been taking place in the shady recesses of the Turtle Mountains for several years. The picnics celebrated the long history of peaceful relations between the U.S. and Canada. It was out of these peace picnics, which were attended by as many as 5,000 people, that the dream of a permanent peace garden was born. The founders envisioned a natural landscape complemented by the work of leading gardeners and landscape artists of both nations. Their vision excluded any commercial development. They were seeking legislation that would disallow any gasoline stations, roadhouses, dance pavilions, or other resorts within 5 miles of the park, providing a protected zone. No small thinkers, they asked for $5 million right in the middle of America's Great Depression, over $70 million in today's dollars. One-fifth of that would be used for direct improvements of the park, and four-fifths would be set aside as a permanent endowment to assure proper maintenance down through the years. The organizers sought support from service clubs, the state and provincial governments, individual donors, and even the nickels and dimes of American and Canadian school children. Perhaps the financial bleakness of the 1930s and the fear of another war had helped inspire the Peace Garden planners, but in July of 1932, 50,000 individuals traveled from all over the United States and Canada to witness the groundbreaking and dedication ceremony for this unique and enduring garden in the center of North America, the International Peace Garden. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Russell Ford Dunker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A few minutes left in Main Street to remind you we are in our short and sweet membership drive, which means we only have a day or so more to remind you of the importance of supporting what you're listening to. Ashley Thornburg and I have been throwing out the number and the website. That's 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. We've got a special treat, too, for those people who like the sweet part of Short and Sweet.
I think this even goes beyond special. I'm going to go ahead and use the word heavenly. These are cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry, and they are our thank you gift. Beyond, of course, the exceptional programming that you've come to rely on and that we think you deserve to hear here on Prairie Public. But if you contribute at $10 a month or more, you will get a 1-pound box of cocoa truffles sent to anywhere in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day. So if you have someone off in college or in a nursing home, or you want to spice things up at home or share these with absolutely no one and just have a wonderful moment with yourself, get a box of these cocoa truffles. $10 a month gets you a 1-pound box. It starts with a simple phone call, 1-800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org, and you have the opportunity to leave a little note, a Valentine's Day message.
Now, we like to think that our show, Ashley, is an incubator of civil conversation. And for those of you out there who've been listening to all this shock talk, hot talk on broadcast, whether it's a cable channel or a local radio station, whatever, we like to think we go about this process a bit differently. We like to spend some time talking to the people we want to interview on our show, and we don't want to, you know, yell at them or have them yell at us for that matter. That's the kind of programming you hear here. We spend some time preparing for it, and we want to give you information that is useful, that is truthful, and that you might find an interest in. And of course, you're listening now, so we happen to think you're invested in this kind of radio, at least for your ears, but maybe you need to invest in it literally to keep it coming. And that's easy to do. It's a very short phone call or a very short time online, but it makes a big difference. We are member-supported radio. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
Main Street is a great way to get to know names, faces, people across the state. And it never ceases to amaze me how many fascinating, engaging, passionate, wonderful people there are in this state. You know, sometimes in North Dakota, it feels like you kind of know everybody. And especially if you're from a small town, you feel like you know everything there is to know about these people. And then you'll just be floored with, wait a second, you're an inventor? Or wait a second, you gave birth to 21 children in 21 years? Or what have you? People are doing incredible things across this region, and that is what fuels the work that we do here, telling these stories. It is a beautiful, vast, rugged part of the country, these windswept prairies, that prairie stoic attitude. It's the dynamic people that make up this state, and that is why we want to tell these stories. Meet them on Main Street. 1-800-359-4145 supports those conversations so you get to know a little bit more about those neighbors.
And of course, on Friday, it's the end of the month, and we will have our monthly journalist roundtable, which will convene to discuss the big stories. Among the topics, the outlook for spring flooding, which has got a lot of us concerned, and the governor's State of the State address, which he gave this week. Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson was always with us for these journalists' roundtable, and he will be joined tomorrow by special guests Cecile Wehrman, editor of the Crosby Journal and Tioga Tribune, and Kimberly Wynn, managing editor of the Grand Forks Herald. In the meantime, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.